A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making that pound in your pocket go a little bit further. Now this is the time of the week where we welcome the team from This Is Money, that's the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, into the Consuming Issues studio. With me today, editor Simon Lambert is here with journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Lee Boyce back at the This Is Money HQ for their weekly catch-up, where they'll be talking about the stories that they've been looking into this week, including the Bank of England's latest inflation report. What does it all mean for our pockets? Well, customers are leaving Barclays after being told they're too poor. Why pensioner bonds have been extended? And why does it cost twice as much to phone countries, some countries in Europe, than those much further afield? We'll let you know.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues, time of the week, yes, where we welcome the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, into the studio to tell us the stories that they've been investigating on our behalf this week. Editor Simon Lambert here with journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Well, let's start with the big news on inflation. And according to the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, the UK could temporarily turn negative in the spring because of falling oil prices. Our Chancellor George Osborne, he says this isn't something to worry about at the moment, so they're both in agreement of that one. But what if we did dip into deflation? Simon, you've written about this, and before I ask about your views, I want to know the difference between deflation and negative inflation, or disinflation, stagflation.
Well, I mean, to be perfectly honest, if you look at the deflation that tends to be feared by economists, it's a long, prolonged period of deflation, perhaps where you're seeing a sizable number, you know, maybe 3-4% deflation. What we're talking about here is potentially dipping below zero and maybe seeing -1% for a short while before it goes back up, due to what the Bank of England have suggested are temporary factors, which is mainly the fall in the oil price.
Am I right in thinking that they didn't include in the figures then oil, energy and food? So have they done what they do in America, where they call it the cold and hungry index? They take away all the issues like fuel and food, because those are things that you have to buy. So it's not something you can put off buying. And when you think about the core substances, that's why they think it's not deflation, because we're not putting those things off.
Yeah, and that's true, because ultimately what's causing this fall in inflation is the fact that basically the oil price has fallen a lot. So year on year, petrol prices are down substantially. Food prices are falling because the supermarkets are engaging in a bit of a price war at the moment and cutting prices. And also you're seeing energy costs come down, and that actually hasn't really come into it yet, but will come into it in the months ahead. And that's going to push things lower. Those are judged to be temporary factors. So in a year's time, it's likely that the oil price might have gone up, so petrol prices will be rising. In a year's time, I'm not sure we can rely on the generosity of our energy companies to be continuing to cut prices. And the supermarkets might have decided that they don't want to continue engaging in a price war. So what the Bank of England is saying is we can look through these figures, and they've said that they think inflation will be back towards the 2% target by around about sort of 2 years' time.
He also did revise up the bank's growth and wage forecasts as well.
Yes, because fundamentally what's being suggested here is that we've got this is going to be good deflation. This is going to be the kind of deflation that puts more money in people's pockets and helps the economy. And so we're going to see a bit more growth. And, you know, the big thing that's always said here is the fall in the oil price is basically going to benefit consumers because they'll be spending less money on petrol, and also businesses because they'll be spending less money on the cost of production and the cost of transportation. So this deflation could be a good thing. But listen to economists, they tell you deflation is a bad thing.
Exactly. And this is the subject of your article, because you studied economics, and we've always heard deflation is bad.
Yeah, that's been the core message of the past 6 years. We've spent 6 years fighting the prospect of deflation. We've cut interest rates to 0.5% 6 years ago, and they haven't moved since. We printed £375 billion worth of money, and 6 years later, we're now going to get some deflation. But the suggestion is that deflation is bad for a number of reasons. One, people put off buying today what they would buy because they think it will be cheaper tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Also, that basically debts grow in real terms because basically the amount of that debt would normally be eroded by inflation. The cost of living rising means that that debt buys less stuff in the future. With deflation, if the cost of living is falling, then that debt, you know, it grows in size, in theory. And also that businesses struggle to have any pricing power. Now, my argument is that we've been seeing those three things for a number of years.
Rachel?
It depends really what items are going down in cost. The major ones here, as you've said, are food and oil. These aren't things that you're going to not buy because you think that they might get cheaper later. So that's not so much of a problem. But most other things, 68% of the rest of the basket of goods that are looked at, have gone up in price. And so long as that's still the case, then if, on average, we go into deflation, it's not so much of a problem.
Mark Carney hasn't ruled out, though, another round of what you're talking about, QE, nor a cut in interest rates as well.
Although he very heavily caveated that. That was said quite early on in the when the inflation report was delivered. And he said, you know, we don't think we're going to have to do this, but if things get worse and deflation gets baked in, this scenario where you do get persistent deflation, we might have to cut rates, we might have to print more money. Then he was asked a number of times whether the Bank of England was likely to cut rates further, because what we've seen is, you know, cuts to negative interest rates in the Eurozone. We saw it in Sweden as well yesterday. But he said, if you look at the path of interest rates that we are saying is going to happen, the next move is a rise. And it seems highly unlikely, I think, that we will cut interest rates in this country. I'm not even sure whether it would really actually achieve anything. One of the points I made in the article I wrote about deflation, which I said, don't fear the effects of deflation. We've been feeling them for years. And that is that since the financial crisis arrived, we have had stagnant wages and earnings falling in real terms. So as most people pay their debts with their wages, this effectively does mean that what they owe has swollen. We've also got the chance that buying anything, we want to buy anything, that it could get cheaper in the future, because we've got shops that have permanently got sales on. This is the reason why people leave their shopping until right up to Christmas. Our retail sector has itself created a deflationary effect. Also, you know, with businesses' pricing power, businesses are already struggling with pricing power because the internet is essentially deflationary. We can now compare the cost of almost anything that we want to buy, be it a washing machine or a big ticket item or a flight to go on holiday, even, you know, our shopping or a minicab. Look at Uber. All of these things are by their very nature deflationary. And what it's doing is it's putting more money into people's pockets. And that's probably a good thing because we've tried having low interest rates for 6 years and various other things. And to be honest, it's not really encouraging people to spend. It's not really working. So maybe this is the thing that actually does give us that nice big heft up.
Well, it's true. I mean, is he really going to go back to QE, cut interest rates? Probably not. But he needs to say something to provide a reassurance, I suppose, that we can take action. There are still tools left in our toolkit should we need them. And also, it's sort of a boast about the state of our economy and what the Bank of England has done to our banks, that they could now cope, he says, with a further interest rate cut that they couldn't before.
A lot of numbers in this speech from Mark Carney. What does it actually all practically mean? Are we literally feeling this? We're hearing cost of living crisis. Do we actually believe that things are feeling cheaper, that we're paying off debt?
Well, we've had mixed reactions from readers here. Some of them have said, well, I'm not feeling it in my pocket. And that's certainly true. I'm not sure how many people would feel that they've, you know, feel substantially richer from this. But I think people do notice things like the cost of petrol, the cost of filling up your car falling. They notice that quite a bit. Cuts to energy prices. People are going to feel that a bit because they're not going to feel them going up. And also, I think people are starting to potentially feel that their food shopping is getting a little bit cheaper, or at least they're not feeling that it's getting constantly more expensive. And we have had this, you know, cost of living squeeze. And if you ask people about the thing that has generally concerned them most over the last 5 years, a lot of people would say, my bills keep going up and my wages aren't going up. Well, now that is reversing and wages are starting to pick up, and bills, at least if they're not, you know, going down, they're not going up by as much. So people are feeling the effect. The other key thing to take from this is that the Bank of England said that if things continue as they are, they will aim to raise interest rates along the curve of what the market is suggesting. And that suggests that interest rates aren't going up until spring 2016. So it suggests that interest rates won't rise this year. And you can put a lot of money in your pocket at the moment if you've got a mortgage, and you can remortgage by remortgaging to a lower rate. That has the power to seriously boost your disposable income.
Simon, before we move on to Barclays, how do you think Mark Carney's done, Bank of England?
Oh, central bankers, they're the new rock stars, aren't they? You know, you've got Mark Carney, Mario Draghi. I think he's done a reasonable job. He was brought in to basically try and instill some confidence into the economy and things like that. And there's this comparison that's been drawn between sort of some of the actions of some central bankers nowadays and this thing called the Maradona effect, where basically Diego Maradona used to regularly manage to run straight up a football pitch with the ball at his feet, straight past all of the midfielders and all the defenders, and then go score a goal, because they were expecting him to swerve. And he'd sort of move this way and he'd move that way, but he'd never actually swerve, and it meant he could just run straight up the pitch in a line. And this is the suggestion of what central bankers are doing, like Mark Carney and Mario Draghi, is they're sort of indicating to the markets that they might have to make this move and they might have to swerve. But what they're actually managing to do is run straight down the middle.
And hopefully he'll score a goal. The voice you're hearing is Simon Lambert. Also in the studio with me, journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Rachel?
In terms of the ways that he's been sort of pressed so far, though, I mean, he sort of came in just when things were looking up. So while there's been a lot of talk, there's been talk of forward guidance and...
Forward guidance?
Well, so he'll... You know, he said that interest rates wouldn't go up until unemployment fell below 7%. And then they did, and still they didn't go up.
He's been likened to a fickle lover, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. A fickle lover. Rachel's got a point here. They've moved the goalposts a lot, the Bank of England. And he's had a fairly easy ride, hasn't he, don't you think?
Well, he hasn't pushed up QE because he hasn't had to. He hasn't moved interest rates. So what has he done so far? Talk. And what he has said... If you sort of look retrospectively at the guidance he gave and then what ended up happening, there are considerable disparities. I'm not saying it's his fault. Who could have predicted what would happen to oil over the past 6 months? But, you know, I'm not sure he's quite a rock star any longer.
Rachel Rickard-Strauss, unconvinced by the George Clooney-looking Diego Maradona-style governor of the Bank of England.
The Big Number, demystifying finance.
The base rate, or what's more formally known as the bank rate, is set by the Bank of England. It's the rate at which the central bank will lend to other banks, and it's used as the benchmark for interest rates generally. It's an incredibly important number because it influences many aspects of the wider economy, and it touches on everyone's financial lives. The Bank of England has to control monetary stability, and that means it must keep inflation low. It controls the cost of money by influencing the interest rates. By changing the rate at which it will lend to banks, it affects the whole range of interest rates that banks, building societies, and other institutions will charge customers for loans and pay them in interest for their deposits. A reduction in interest rates makes saving less attractive and borrowing more attractive. As interest rates fall and saving becomes less popular, people may increasingly look for profit in the stock market and other investments. Changes in interest rates also affect the ability of companies to borrow to invest. In addition, it has an impact on the value of our currency that in turn can affect the price of our exports and imports. So, changes in the bank or base rate can have multiple effects throughout the economy. It's therefore one of the most powerful tools in the hands of the Bank of England and exerts a big influence on the shape of the economy.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
And this is Consuming Issues here on Share Radio, on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1. In the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss, the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of The Mail Online. They come in every week into the studios. Now let's turn our attention, Simon and Rachel, if you wouldn't mind, to Barclays Bank. Your article here says a loyal customer's leaving Barclays after being told they're too poor. A huge 270,000 customers being moved from their Premier Life account to a basic one, and with it losing various perks, including travel insurance. Barclays say when the accounts close, only those earning $75,000 a year or those who have $100,000 in saving will be eligible now for that Premier Current account. Well, I gather This Is Money have been rather inundated with emails about this, Rachel.
Well, what it is Barclays is shutting its Premier Life account. Actually, it's been shut since 2012, but now existing customers who are allowed to stay on it until now are being shoved off it.
Why did they shut it?
Well, they call it, and it's this wonderful word in personal finance, simplification. What it means is they'll move customers either to a basic account or to a premier one. If you have £100,000 in savings or you earn £75,000, you'll be moved to the premier account. If you do not, you'll lose the lovely account that you run and get put on a basic one. And it turns out this is a fairly emotive subject for a lot of people who have had this account for a long time.
What have they been saying?
It just seems quite harsh. Loyal customers of Barclays who have had this account that they've paid £25 a month for it and they've been happy to pay it have now been told, you're no longer good enough for us to have it.
It's the wording as well, isn't it? The wording upset people.
If you would like to continue benefiting from a Premier account, you will have to meet the following criteria, and then it spelled out the £100,000 and £75,000 in income.
Which you imagine a lot of elderly people perhaps might be quite badly hit by that, because they might not be earning $75,000.
Well, that's it. And a lot of these people will be elderly customers who have had this account for a long time, have enjoyed the perks. With it, you got travel insurance, you got breakdown cover. The thing that people seem to like was access to airport lounges, and they'll lose all that. Actually, I think that most people will end up better off, because on the basic account, you can add what they call bolt-ons. So you can pay a few quid to add on the travel insurance or to add on the airport lounge access. And you only add on whatever it is that you would use. Exactly. And so rather than paying 25 quid, you might end up, well, if you're really only using the travel insurance, you pay £7 instead. Much better. If you added all of it together, it would add up to £27 versus 25. So it would be more expensive. But in reality, is everyone going to use all of those facilities? Probably not.
Well, in that case, what's the problem? Had they called it, you know, Sparkly Life account instead, or Gold Platinum Uber Duber Diamond account, maybe that would have been better.
I think that's it. And if they had just managed the situation better, not have worded it so brashly, it wouldn't have been quite so transparent that what they were saying is your loyalty doesn't pay what does ultimately is wealth.
Well, if people do decide that they're not happy with this and they want to switch, how can they go about doing so?
My suggestion would be that people need to look very carefully at any form of packaged account that they're paying for and work out, are they using all the benefits and how much is this costing them in total? Because to me, £25 a month sounds like an awful lot of money to pay for a bank account. And I understand that there will be some customers who were taking full advantage of it. But, you know, to be honest, there will be quite a lot of them who weren't and could have paid for all of those things separately. For example, the airport lounge access, great perk. But quite often you can just pay a one-off fee. Travel insurance, I mean, you can do a comparison on that. You can quite often get, you know, good prices and also get better cover in many instances. Although actually one of the elements here that will have been important to people was the travel insurance up to age 80, because it does get much harder to get travel insurance as you get older. So I would have looked at it. I would look at any account such as this, be it the Barclays one or any other one, and say, is it worth paying for? I'd then look at the other accounts that are on the market and say, well, how do they fit in with me? And can they offer me a better deal for my lifestyle? And there are accounts out there that will pay you interest. You can get 5% interest from your current account. There are accounts out there that will pay you to join. First Direct will pay you £125 to join them. To me, that sounds like a better prospect than paying £25 a month for a bank account. But then I wouldn't use all of these things. There are, you know, bank accounts that will offer you other special things. And it's a case of sitting down, thinking which one will work out best for you, and then switching, which is a comparatively painless process to what it would have been some years ago. The new switching rules mean it should be done within 7 days. And actually, most of the banks have got pretty good systems in place that says if anything goes wrong, they'll fix it for you. And I think most people should be sitting down, if they haven't moved their bank account, looking at it and saying, can I move? Can I get a better deal for me? Because do you owe Barclays 20 years of loyalty? Most people just don't move. It's just inertia.
It is. I mean, people, I think, feel a certain loyalty after a time, goodness knows why, to a bank. I don't know that I've come across a case in the world of personal finance where loyalty pays. It's always, you know, teaser rates or 6 months off your half-price broadband for new customers. It never makes sense not to shop round and make sure that you're getting the best deal. And now, in terms of these packaged accounts, it seems like if they are something that you like, it's a good time to do it. There seems to be a move towards these bolt-ons, which make a lot more sense.
So, Nance, how common are these packaged accounts?
I think 1 in 5 of us have them. And there was a bit of a crackdown by the regulator, a lot of scrutiny over them, where the regulator started questioning why should people be paying for services that they can't necessarily use. Say in the case of this Premier Life, if you're aged 85, you won't be able to use the travel insurance, but you're still sort of effectively paying for it as part of the bundle. Or why are you paying for breakdown cover if potentially you don't have a car? So it makes more sense, I think, to move in the direction that Barclays and others are doing, to have this bolt-on system where you pay only for what you're going to use.
Let's find out a little bit more about Barclays.
The Barclays Bank we know today came about through an 1896 merger of 20 well-known Quaker banking firms, but its roots can be traced even further to the 1700s. In its early days, many customers would not have been able to read and write, making the bank's famous Black Eagle logo just as important for recognition on the high street as the name above the door. Historically, Barclays has been one of Britain's most innovative banks. It was the first bank to issue a credit card in the UK, the first in the world to install an ATM, and more recently, through Barclaycard, gave us the first contactless payment card. Barclays was at the centre of the credit crunch tsunami in 2008, but it was able to cut a clear path through the financial crash, avoiding a government bailout and even picking up American investment bank Lehman Brothers on the way. This led to some of the press dubbing it the Houdini Bank. As the worst effects of the crash subsided, Barclays was accused, along with Royal Bank of Scotland and UBS, of manipulating a key interest rate known as LIBOR. As a result, the city regulator fined Barclays £60 million. With 1,500 branches in the UK, it is Britain's second biggest bank by market capitalisation, with a value of over £36 billion. Like many banking shares, prices collapsed during the financial crisis. Barclays shares fell from £7.30 in 2007 to staggering lows of around 47 pence in 2009. But later that year, Barclays share price quickly recovered, rising to about £3.20.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome. If you've just joined us to Consuming Issues here, I'm Georgie Frost. I have with me the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. In the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert, journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss, and on the phone is journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money HQ. Delighted to welcome him to the fold. Now, the pensioner bond story that keeps on giving. That's why we've got Lee, the expert, on the line. Chancellor George Osborne has scrapped his plans to cap the market-beating pensioner bonds at £10 million. The decision comes after more than 610,000 savers have invested £7.5 billion into the bonds, officially known as 65-plus guaranteed growth bonds. Lee, a very good morning.
Morning, Georgie.
Good to hear from you, Lee. When we spoke last time about the pensioner bonds, you didn't know how many had gone. That was all revealed the weekend. Just recap on the idea of these bonds, why they're so popular and how many people have got involved.
Every time I've been on the radio, I have spoken about pensioner bonds. That's how much things seem to change on a sort of week-by-week basis. So last Friday when I was in, there was obviously this £10 billion cap, which meant that a lot of people were worried about missing out on the bonds. We didn't know how much, as you said, had been put into these bonds. Now, over the weekend, George Osborne decided to actually lift the cap and tell us a bit of an update. So, as you rightly said, £7.5 billion has already gone into these accounts, which in a little under 3 weeks, that's a lot of money, and that was closing in on the £10 billion target. Now, the reason why they've been so popular is because the one-year bond offers 2.8% and the three-year bond 4%, which are market-leading rates. You won't get them anywhere else. And also, they actually beat a number of sort of tax-free offerings in the form of an ISA. So a lot of pensioners have got some thinking to do when it comes to what they're doing with their ISA in the coming months as well. And that's why they've been so popular.
Lee, why did this happen? Why did George Osborne make this announcement?
Well, the cynic inside me is thinking that it's because a few weeks ago, well, actually a few days after they launched, he said that they would be on sale for months. Now, £7.5 billion poured in within 3 weeks. They might not have even been around for a whole month. So he would have looked a little bit silly if this had filled up within a month. And you know, that's really the only reason why I can think that these have been sort of, you know, the limit has been extended. And the other thing as well, a lot of people are saying that this is him buying votes ahead of the general election. People have now got until the 15th of May to apply for these, which is a very handy time.
Focusing on the population that tends to vote a little bit more. We knew these bonds would be popular, Lee, but did anyone expect them to be quite this popular?
I think they did. You know, there's been a need for a savings product that actually gives some sort of meaningful return. And this is what the pensioner bonds have done. And people have got money that they want to put somewhere safe that's going to give them a guaranteed return. And there hasn't been anything in the last couple of years. You know, savings rates have absolutely crashed. So something that comes out and beats Best Buys by, you know, a percent or two is always going to be popular.
So how are NS and I doing, those running the bonds? We keep talking about having complications, phone lines, post, etc.
Indeed. So when I came in last Friday, we'd had quite a few number of readers saying that their postal applications had just, you know, disappeared. It seemed that no one could tell them when these bonds were going to be opened. Now, what NS and I told us is that it's taken on more than 700 additional members of staff to cope with these pensioner bonds, and more than half of these are in back office roles to actually put through these postal applications. In the last week, it seems to have calmed down a little bit. The steady stream of readers getting in touch with us has slowed down, so I'm wondering if things are now back on a sort of terms that NS&I wanted, and you know, things have calmed down a little.
So what's the response been from your readers?
In terms of the cap being removed, I mean, it's one of two things. You've got the people that can take advantage of this, that think this is great, and these pensioner bonds are what's needed. But then you've got people that are under 65 that are stuck with bad savings rates asking, hey, where's our incentive to save? It's been a very, very split discussion on our comments board.
Yes, anyone under 65, but people who are young.
Exactly. There's no incentive for people to save. And I've made this point before, but we are built on credit. You know, this nation is built on credit, and people under 40, for example, are more likely to have a credit card probably than have a savings account with any meaningful amount of money in there. And, you know, people do need an incentive to save. And at the moment, 1.5% rates in the form of easy access accounts just ain't cutting it.
Well, what Chancellor George Osborne has been saying in response to some of this criticism, that pensioners, as well as other savers, he points out, suffered because interest rates had fallen, of course, to the historic lows of 0.5% over the past 5 years. And many of these pensioners don't have large sums of money, but relatively small savings. He added, we need to support savers in our country. That's one of the things that went badly wrong in Britain 10 years ago. But it doesn't seem to be for anyone who's under 65. That is the case.
No, it's totally true. And we actually crunched the figures on these pensioner bonds. And the average person has actually stuck £12,300 into the bond. So each bond has a £10,000 limit per person. So that's a lot of money.
I don't know many young people that could put that sort of money into a bond.
No, exactly. And the thing is, you know, it's all well and good putting this product out there for those who can take it out. But, you know, one of the biggest reasons for savings rates falling in the last few years was the Funded for Lending scheme, which, you know, tens of billions of pounds were made available to banks and building societies to tap into. You know, it's cheap money from the government, and it's just reduced the need to entice savers with any kind of attractive rates. So banks can loan out this money in forms of mortgages. That's why we're seeing very, you know, historic low mortgage rates at the moment. And even personal loan rates, you know, are very low, they're very competitive. But when it comes to savings rates, they're absolutely crumbled. So, you know, what is the incentive for people to save?
Journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, I do have to ask you, what's it like back at HQ?
It's busy. It's the epicentre of financial news. You know, everyone is hustle and bustle and writing stuff. It's thrills and spills, I tell you.
But the real news, though, is the kettle's broken.
Yeah, it has. Yeah, absolutely disappointing. A whole week without tea has made me a very grumpy man.
I don't doubt. Well, we'll get Rachel onto that very soon. Thank you very much for joining us. That's journalist Lee Boyce back at This Is Money HQ.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Well, that was journalist Lee Boyce there. Poor thing with a broken kettle. Can Annie even imagine what I would be like with a broken kettle in the Share Radio office? It's just not worth thinking about. Well, with me in the studio this morning, I have editor Simon Lambert and journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss from This Is Money. Editor Simon Lambert, I believe you have to have some people working on your website. Otherwise, you wouldn't be winning those awards, would you? That's why Lee had to stay at base.
Difficult balancing act, yeah. So
it
Lee's
is.
Back there slaving away at his keyboard, writing those great stories for people to read.
Well, you're having a jolly here with us in the studio. I don't know about that. You're working, we work you very hard here. So well, let's turn our attention, if you wouldn't mind, to BT has been busy, apparently simplifying its international calls, but new changes. I mean, it will now cost 20p to call a landline in Russia or Brazil, but double that to do the same for France, Germany or Spain. Rachel, quite rightly, has been asking why it costs more to call countries which are closer. Rachel, what have you found?
I found it's completely bonkers. Again, it's simplification that has led to this, and BT alerted customers that that meant some prices would be going up, others would be going down, which is fair enough. That always happens when you change things round. But it's just interesting that the prices that have gone up are phoning France and Spain, and those that are going down are Brazil and Russia. Why should that be?
Now, you've been focusing on BT, but how does it compare to other providers? Are they alone on this one?
So overall, BT's call charges compare quite favourably to its major competitors. However, no other major phone operator costs more to phone these nearby countries than those that are further away.
I'm not really up to speed on the technology of this, but surely it's the same price. Why does it cost extra?
So, as I understand it, a phone operator will have a contract with a network of a different country, and those charges can vary, and I think that's why it would cost more to call certain countries and others. However, if this were the case, I would imagine that the price movements would be fairly consistent across operators. So is BT just getting a very bad deal? I doubt it.
What have the BT been saying about this?
Fudgy, fudgy, fudge. Yes, you may have noticed that your reader has noticed they said that some of our prices have gone down due to the simplification. They didn't actually address, although I prompted on several occasions, this issue of why it would cost more to phone France than...
Well, this is what a spokesperson for BT said. We've simplified our international call prices to make it easier for customers to know how much they'll be charged. Some prices have come down, including daytime rates for our most popular routes to the USA and Ireland, while others have increased. For customers who make regular international calls, though, they say, we have two options that offer great value: Friends and Family International and International Freedom.
That's true. This is an important point to make. If you do regularly make international phone calls, don't pick up your phone and dial whatever number it is. Make sure you're on some sort of special, you have some sort of bundle or add-on that drives down the cost of calls. Otherwise, it is really expensive. And yes, it's true that they simplified. That's great. It used to be that there was one charge for landlines, another for mobiles, another charge for weekends, another for weekdays. Honestly, trying to work out how much it would cost, you know, to phone France on a Wednesday afternoon from a landline to a landline, you have to go on the website, you scroll through the various PDFs because they change. All of these operators seem to change their charges about every 6 months. It's really complicated.
Simon?
To me, it strikes me that this is just a way of catching people out who sort of every so often call France or Spain, where you're more likely to call. You know, you make a call to France, you spend 5 minutes on the phone, they make a nice bit of money off you, and you won't do that very many times a year. And if you did do that very many times a year, there'd be cheaper ways of doing it, by getting a package or something. But by the time you multiply that up by the number of customers involved, it's a nice little earner, as they say. But, I mean, the thing is, I would say, is if you are calling abroad regularly, don't do it on the phone, because you can do it effectively for free nowadays with things like Skype. I mean, if you've got an iPhone and the other person's got an iPhone, you can call them up and do an audio FaceTime call via, if you've got Wi-Fi, and that's absolutely free. So, really, people who are making regular calls overseas, actually, yes, if they bought one of these packages, it could cut their costs substantially. But you could just be doing it over a computer and paying nothing at all. And I do think that with all these little packages that you get and all these little bolt-ons that you get, it is just a way of taking a bit more money off people in tiny little ways. And one of the issues that underlies all of this around landlines at the moment is landlines are now phenomenally expensive.
So I was thinking, who actually uses a landline anymore?
Well, most people feel that they have to still keep one. They feel that they need to still have one in the home for emergencies. In a lot of cases, you won't actually get the best deal from your broadband provider or your TV provider unless you take their phone line as well. But what they've done over the years is they've steadily ramped up the cost of that landline. So now you might be paying £16 a month for it, whereas go back, you know, sort of 6 years, you could have been paying £10. And there's some really good sort of pricing power being put in here by companies who know that people will just keep paying a little bit extra every month. And interestingly enough, I went to an investment briefing a while back where a fund manager was talking, and they were talking about why they were investing in some of the companies that do you know, your home phone and your broadband and stuff like that. And one of the reasons they gave is how they're now showing quite a bit of pricing power and they're managing to put up prices. And he, in particular, picked out the example of landlines. So he was saying this company's a good investment because it's managing to up prices on people on landlines. So
it's not like BT need the money, do they? They've just forked out quite a lot for EE, a little bit for the football as well.
Well, maybe that's what it is. Maybe you've got to spend more money to call France and Spain because we've spent it all on the football.
And it just seems like such an easy way to cash in, because it's so difficult to compare prices among different operators, and also it's not necessarily what people look at when they choose which operator to go with. You'll go for, particularly when things are bundled together, you might go for the best broadband deal, or maybe you want to watch the sport, whatever it is. You don't really look at how much would it cost me to phone, you know, France on the weekend. And so while it's so difficult to compare prices, then there's not the kind of competition driving them down.
There is one other irony here, which is that due to the EU, we're actually seeing the cost of making mobile phone calls when we're abroad steadily fall because they've been putting this cap in place. Mm-hmm. So it could actually now be cheaper to go to France and use your mobile phone to call someone than it is to use the landline in your house to call France.
It's a money-saving tip there from Simon. I do have to ask you before we move on, what did you make of the BT Sky deal for Premier League football rights? Enormous amount of money paid, over £5 billion, a 71% increase.
To be perfectly honest, I think the amount of money being paid for football TV rights is ridiculous. And the problem I have with it is most of that money is going out into ever higher wages for players, more money for agents. And realistically, I think football probably needs to take a step back and look at what's happening here, because what makes the Premier League interesting is not just the people at the top, it's the people at the bottom, and the people at the bottom come from the Football League. And I think that we worry a lot about passing on some of that money to the grassroots. I think we should be worrying more about passing it on to the clubs in the Football League. And I also think that it would be really nice if clubs just use this as a way of charging people less money to go into their grounds. If they're taking this much money from the TV rights, then why are they charging people £40, £50 for a ticket to watch the game?
It would be wonderful to think that that would happen. Richard Scudamore, though, the chief exec of the Premier League, saying that it's not a charity, it's a business.
It's not a charity, it's a business, but do you know what? It relies on the support of those fans, and I think people are getting a bit disengaged from a game that just consists of bringing in, you know, people with no connection with the club that they're playing from overseas, who play there for a couple of years, get paid, you know, £70,000 a week. Sometimes they don't even play, and then they drift off again. To be honest, if you're going to support a team, you want to see some kind of connection with your local area, and that's drifting further and further away.
Also talking about bringing Premier League football in on a Friday night, 6 days a week of football?
I find, I'm going to sound like an old curmudgeon here.
No.
But honestly, this constant moving around of when sports matches are played. Like, OK, so we had Wednesday and Saturday and Sunday. Great. You know they're going to be on. It regularly happens that, for example, now, you know, now I've disengaged a bit from the England team because, to be honest, they're rubbish.
So have they disengaged.
Yeah, I think the players have disengaged. So I wouldn't be surprised if some of them didn't know what evening they were playing on. But there's an England game coming up and you think, oh, yeah, I'll watch that on Saturday. And then it randomly turns up on TV on a Friday night.
And you've got Europa now that plays on a Thursday. You can have it wall to wall, which I'm sure Annie loves. But for anyone who's not interested in football, will it be relevant because of the huge fees they're paying out, because of this quad play and, like you said, landlines and they're in on everything, broadband, etc. Are we going to see it impact the pound in our pocket?
Money's got to come from somewhere, and it's probably going to come from charging customers more, because the other alternative is you take it out of shareholders' pockets, and shareholders don't like that.
Competition elements as well. Virgin Media, an interesting one, that they've announced what it calls the biggest investment in broadband infrastructure in the UK for more than a decade, investing £3 billion in improving fibre optic broadband network. They're saying it would create 6,000 new jobs, of which 1,000 would be apprenticeships. Good news for the market?
I think that's good news. I think, you know, spending money on improving the infrastructure is definitely a good thing. I mean, Virgin is now, they run what we used to, is the old cable infrastructure. And what you notice about that is that whilst we're told that, you know, the fibre optic and cable is much, much better, actually some of that's getting a bit old now. We're where I live is one of the original cable areas, and our broadband is nowhere near as reliable as it's promoted as by Virgin. So spending a bit more money on improving the network is definitely a good thing.
You have to think forward as well. I mean, 5 years ago, we were using, a few browsers and maybe watching the odd video on YouTube. If you're investing for the next sort of decade, two decades, who knows what we're going to be doing? You have to make sure that we have an infrastructure that won't hold us back commercially and, you know, also what households choose to do.
We have been talking there about Virgin, big investment in broadband infrastructure, and why BT charges twice as much to phone France and Spain as Russia or Brazil. Let's find out a little bit more about BT.
BT is the world's oldest communications company, with links going back to the 1840s. In its early days, Britain's telecommunications industry was a countrywide mix of small companies until they were amalgamated and put under the control of the post office. They later became a privatised company called British Telecommunications, the forerunner of the BT Group. Today, the BT Group is made up of four businesses: Openreach, which manages the UK telecoms infrastructure, BT Retail, BT Wholesale, and finally, BT Global Service. BT promotes its environmental record and is sourcing 100% of its UK electricity from renewable energy, making it one of the largest UK commercial companies to do so. BT is Europe's largest telecom service wholesaler by revenue, and globally it serves customers in more than 170 countries. BT has not always been at the forefront of the latest technology, however. It sold off its mobile phone division, was late into television, and is being fiercely fought over the frontiers of fibre optic superfast broadband. However, BT benefits from its infrastructure heritage. It owns the only telephone network that reaches the entire population of the UK. Emerging competitors still need BT for the last mile of the telephone network, so it still has a major hold on the UK telecoms industry. Despite some ups and downs in its own share price, BT shares have substantially outperformed the FTSE 100 between 2010 and late 2014.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1 on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. I have with me in the studio the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Editor Simon Lambert is here with journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss for our weekly catch-up. Now, families are paying as much as £780 for a £229 tumble dryer. That's thanks to giant interest rates as high as 94.7% APR at rent-to-own retailers. That's led MPs to urge for change to protect some of the poorest consumers. Rachel, you've been investigating this story for us. Which providers are people using?
So there are three main rent-to-own retailers. Bright House is by far the biggest, but there's also Perfect Home and Buyers You View. And they allow customers to buy goods and pay them off over a longer period of time. So if you can't afford to buy, say, a washing machine up front, then you pay a small amount every week or every month until you've paid off the full amount.
Is that the idea of the buying on the never-never that we used to hear people talk about?
Well, I think that this is the problem, is it can be years until people have paid them off. And you end up paying sometimes 94.7%, I think, percent APR, plus then they bung in insurance costs as well. And if you fall behind on your payments, they can reclaim it, regardless of how much you've already paid up front.
So why are these stores appealing to people? Who are the typical consumers?
Well, it's people who, I think the average customer of one of these stores has £19 a week that they could spend on one-off costs. Everything else is already eaten up by sort of essential bills. If you've got £19 a week, I don't know how you'd save up really for a washing machine.
So there are obviously benefits to these companies.
Absolutely. I mean, for this is what they'll argue as well, is for many people, this is the only way that lots of families can afford to buy big ticket items, and they are providing a service there. And it is also true that, as they would argue as well, I'm sure, that there is a certain, you take a certain risk on these customers that they might not be able to pay back. So perhaps, yes, you charge interest rates. However, 94% plus compulsory sort of tied in insurance costs. So they don't